John, how long have you been here at the Research Council?
I'm just coming up on the completion of my 11th year.
What keeps you here?
Well, first of all, it's really fun to be involved with a bunch of eclectic people, very bright people who really want to make a difference in the community and society and so on. But also it keeps you sort of right in the forefront of what's going on in the world, because technology is embedded in so much of everything. So it's exciting, a great place to learn and stay informed and hopefully contribute a little bit.
Well, who is it that you would meet through your work from around the world? People like yourself, or who are dealing with some of these new technologies or the discoveries that we deal with every day?
Well, with this role, you get involved, of course, with senior scientists and leaders in organizations like ARC across Canada, North America, and around the world. You get involved with the academic community because you are constantly looking there to sort of harvest ideas and thoughts and, of course, to recruit smart people. You get involved with industry, so you deal with industry leaders, you begin to understand their problems, you have an opportunity to sort of learn what's on their mind. And you get involved with people who are trying to put technology to work every day in practice. The people running things like Alberta Newsprint, or right on the line and trying to make the sheets stay together, or whatever. You see everybody, literally.
Well, in your case, you're the fellow who has to kind of steer the boat or steer the ship. And while you have all these scientists around you working on various things, you're the one who has to set the direction for what they are going to be working on or where it might go. How do you set that vision? How do you decide where innovation is going to take you?
Well, there's a few things that come to bear. And first of all, you're overemphasizing my contribution. But having said that, we do a lot of looking at what's going on. So you have to get out there and do a lot of reading. You've got to do a lot of talking. You've got to interact with industry and government. You have to find out really what their concerns are, and also be able to sort of project into the future a little bit from what you hear, so you can identify emerging concerns. So we've created people to help us do that, like our chair of foresight. We then ask our scientists to participate, so they also are letting us know what goes on. We engage with our board, which gives us another touchstone to the outside world, and say, here's the kind of things we're thinking about. How does that resonate with what you're hearing, with what you're seeing? And you attend conferences. You basically have to be kind of a sponge to soak up as many ideas as you possibly can. That's the easy part, actually. Takes a lot of work, but it's actually the easy part. The hard part is to start to synthesize it all, try to really create a model of the system in which technology is being applied, sort out where the major constraints, bottlenecks, or problems are, and then, in effect, say that's the kind of agenda that would really make a difference. Now, we found that that is far and away the hardest job we have to do. And I wish I could give you a recipe for doing it, but I can't. What I do know is that it takes interaction. One person can't do it alone. You have to be willing to be blatantly honest, so you're not caring and championing your favorite idea. You're really trying to beat up every idea and find out what might be wrong with it, where are the deficiencies or whatever, not in a negative way, but because you're really trying to understand the challenges of particular systems.
Well, can you give me an example of something you've had to work through here that would sort of illustrate how you go through this process?
Yeah, I'll give you a classic, actually, and it's part of ARC's evolution. So ARC was really founded to help produce energy in a way, find ways to be able to economically produce that resource we call oil sands. And we did that. Ultimately, technology emerged and so on. But the early work on production has been superseded by much more work now on how to make the producing activities less impactful, more benign, to deal with the CO2 emissions, to use less water, to reduce the footprint on the land, and so on. Now, those kind of issues we began to see emerging fairly early, 15, 20 years ago, as the early projects were being put in place, you could see these things. Now, they weren't necessarily recognized by the public at large. The regulators didn't pursue them because the public didn't recognize them yet, and so on. But the good news is our people did, and they began to try to come to grips with how do you deal with them. So our work in carbon capture and storage, which is now being talked about and seems to be the mantra of the day, actually began more than 15 years ago. And that's why, in fact, we can talk about carbon capture and storage today, is because a lot of work was done to try to put the technology in place, to understand how it would work, to do some experimental work, to get out into the field and try things out and so on. Without that, we'd still be essentially where we were 15 years ago, but with a much bigger problem to deal with.
Because you were working on something before it really captured the public's attention, it meant you had to be a champion for that at a time when perhaps it wouldn't have gotten, say, the economic or political support for that kind of research. How have you managed to do that, to maintain that role of supporting that kind of esoteric, in a way, research, which you know sometime down the road is going to provide us with things that we really need?
Well, this is where we have to develop a rather interesting relationship with the politicians, because after all, we're owned by the province. So how does this play out? Essentially, the politicians have to have enough confidence in us that they will give us the ability to invest some resources largely based on our own assessments of need. And that takes a lot of confidence. So one of the things that's very important is to maintain the confidence. If you go back to the beginning of ARC, what the government at the time said is this is really important. It's important enough that we will put public money in. Now, we went through a stage where there was huge pressure to say, well, wean yourself from the need to for government support. And we've moved a long way in that regard, not to change so much our role in life, but to change the way in which we approach it. So we have a very large proportion now of our work which is funded through contracts. But contracts inevitably are short-term. Okay, they're about today's problems. So we have to argue very strongly, and we have to be able to create this level of confidence that will allow us to be exploring the future, and that requires the base support that we get. And that's why, for us, we've come to the conclusion that sort of 25 to 30% of our budget really has to come by way of a grant that gives us the wherewithal to put in place the people and the facilities that allow us to address these problems. But it does come with this sense of trusteeship, is the best way to describe it, that the government is confident enough that we'll make the right decisions. Now, we don't make all the right decisions. I wouldn't pretend that. But we have to be at least identifying enough of them early enough that the politicians continue to see the value, largely from what we've done in the past as opposed to what we're doing today.
You've just come through an exercise where you've gathered a bunch of people together to look into the future and to deal with this foresight or vision. Where could we be going down the road? Tell me about that.
Well, the first thing I'll tell you is that in a way, it's a direct extension of your last question. The government doesn't give me the grant, right? It gives the institution a grant in order to do the right things. So the question is, how do we know what the right things are? And so we've been constantly looking for ways to get input from very smart people that represent a wide spectrum of views, both scientifically, politically, socially, and so on, who will come together and help us identify some of the places where the real challenges of the next 10 or 15 years are going to be found, so that we can, in fact, invest properly.
Who came to the exercise?
Well, in that particular case, we had about 60 people from around the world. We tried to ensure there was a core group of Albertans, because we have to have some Alberta sort of credibility, reality, if you like. I mean, we're trying to work on behalf of Albertans, and so we wanted to make sure that that knowledge base was at the table. We invited people from the rest of Canada, so we had a good number of them as well. And then we invited people from around the world, largely for their expertise. We addressed food, water, and energy, because they're the fundamentals both of life and also of industry. And the idea was to recognize increasingly that these are areas that sort of interplay one against the other. So what we do with water affects our lives, it affects our food, it's necessary for industry and energy and so on. You know, you can grow crops for consumption, or you can grow them to make fuel out of, or you can make products out of them, you can, and so on. So these things are very much more these days are, I won't say competitive, but they're certainly interrelated.
How did the discussion go along? How did you actually shape or guide the discussion?
Well, we asked some knowledgeable people to sort of set the stage in each area, trying to avoid their own opinions, but also trying to be provocative. So they provided the hard knowledge about where things are, and they raised questions and issues that they saw as needing answers. And then we had sort of group sessions in which people could decide whether those, in fact, were the right issues or not. They could add their own. They could reformulate them. And we did that in each of the three areas. And then we had a sort of an integrating session where we said, okay, it's great to have dealt with them in their individual silos. How do they, in fact, interact with one another? And that was actually the most exciting session of all.
You say people have different expertise. What are some of those areas? What were the fields that these people were drawn from?
Well, for example, we had a Stockholm Water Prize winner from the U.S., which is like the Nobel Prize in Water Research, attend. And what does he do? Well, he knows virtually everything you'd care to know about water, actually. On the other extreme, we had the head of the International Institute for Sustainable Cities. And her interest is how cities work, how they can maintain access to water, how they can make sure that it's high quality and that it's not wasted and so on. And then we had one of the world's leading international consultants on energy out of the UK. We had people from Africa who sort of live on the ground and watch people sort of trying to scrape livelihoods out of these areas and so on. So all of these things kind of come together and provided a remarkable balance, you know. So we had producers, we had consumers, we had public interest people and not-for-profit groups and NGOs and so on. We tried to minimize what I would call government, because we felt in this kind of an environment, we had a few, but in this kind of environment, we're not trying to understand what governments are trying to do today. We're trying to understand what the issues are that they're going to confront tomorrow. So there is a time to engage government, but we didn't think that was the time.
What were the ideas, the provocative ideas that came out of this?
Well, one of the most interesting things, I think, is that there was absolute consensus from all parties. There actually isn't a shortage of food or water or energy in the world, which is not intuitively obvious, because it's not the sort of thing we read in the newspapers or whatever. What there is an enormous amount of wastage which occurs throughout the systems. And so, for example, you know, anywhere from 20 to 50% of the food that's produced actually never gets used. It's either destroyed or wasted or whatever along the way. In water, there many of our systems are leaky. They're wasteful. They're you know. So again, there's lots of problems. And in energy, the same thing applies. So that again is rather interesting. It's the challenge is not so much on supply, it's on accessibility, it's on distribution, it's on minimizing waste and using it effectively, it's on all of those kind of things. So it takes you down quite a different path than a lot of people would otherwise typically work in.
Any others?
That's a very open question. I mean, there's, you could go on and on. But I think one of the other things that that for me was instructive is that there's a certain concern, would be the best way to describe it, about the fact that our systems have become so large and interconnected that we're making them increasingly vulnerable to any kind of a disruption. So a small disruption, in effect, will now have enormous consequences. So that leads people to want to have a much heavier focus on distributed systems, on smaller systems that maybe connect to the larger ones but aren't totally reliant on them. So we're not quite as vulnerable, and we have more security in our lives and so on. There's also a sense that because systems are so large that the common person loses any ability to influence because they don't know where to push, and even if you do push, you're sort of one person in this enormous structure. So it's a bit like me going downtown and moving, trying to lean against an office building to move it. Nothing will happen, right? And people actually want to be able to influence their lives somewhat. So that's an interesting thing, and it tells us that for us, we have to be thinking maybe more of microsystems, of distributed systems, of smaller ways of doing things. And I think the final thing that's rather intriguing for me that sort of resonated out of the event is the idea that nature is actually pretty smart, and if we can mimic nature more in what we do by ensuring that we really do think holistically as opposed to linearly, so we think about the system where it's the wastes of one are feeding into another part and so on, as opposed to just taking something and processing it and throwing the rest away, that's very important too.
So how do you take that and then incorporate it into what you will do here at the Research Council?
Well, with those and with the areas in which we work and the realities of Alberta, we now start to drill down. So we'll drill down into these various areas in more detail and say, okay, given those kinds of concerns, they become almost the constraints in which we're going to think. Right? It gives us some parameters so that you're not just doing anything that looks interesting. You're actually doing things within a constrained environment. So Jasper has given us some constraints to our thinking, which is helpful. The next challenge is to sort out what the real driving force is within given sectors. And that requires you to really, really understand it. And that is incredibly difficult, as we're finding. So, for example, if we're looking at say, oil and gas, typically what companies want is more reserves at a reasonable price that they can put on their books so their stock price goes up, right? And yes, they also want to produce them ultimately at a reasonable value and so on. But government, to some degree, wants the same thing, right? They want more reserves that create, in a sense, the future wealth base for the province. But their concern is first of all, that they are producible. So if we have a natural resource, we can actually use it. And so in some ways, the two come together, right? But the government's interest is in order to generate wealth to help the population to do other things. So we have to be able to kind of link these sorts of things together and say, all right, what's the best advantage? And of course, overarching it all is this sustainability exercise, which is, it's great to be able to book reserves cheaply, but if you do it at the expense of the water table or the airshed or the whatever, that's not acceptable, right? And so on. So these are the balancing acts that we ultimately come to. And then with that information, you then throw the challenges out to your technology people, the scientists and the engineers and so on, and say, okay, here's what we would like to have happen. Bring us your ideas about how to do it. So we've given them, in a sense, some constraints. You know, we haven't just said go out and do whatever you want. We've said we want to solve this kind of problem, and these are the parameters in which you have to solve it. And those will have emission parameters, cost parameters, performance parameters, and so on. And if we do those things, then at the end of the day, you know, you'll have an expanded industry or another industry or a better environment or whatever it may be.
InnoVentures Canada is your baby. What was the impetus behind that?
Well, it's in many ways, it's what we've been talking about. It's that solving problems of consequence is not about making a little incremental step in science or even usually a breakthrough in science. It's about being able to deal with the system as a whole and be able to put all the pieces together to give someone a complete solution as opposed to just a component. I like to describe it to people by saying, I'm building a house, so this is maybe where my analogy comes from, but I could build a house by simply having the building supply store dump all the things I might need on the front lawn, right? And so I have a nice pile of stuff, but it wouldn't help me much in building the house. What I need is I need a plan, so I order the right stuff in the right quantities. I need to do things in certain sequences. So, having the paint there when I haven't dug the basement yet is kind of a waste because it's probably going to freeze in the wintertime and be destroyed and so on. So I've got to think things through. Now, what does all that say? Well, it says that if I'm going to build a house, I need all of these pieces, but I also need all the people who can deal with the pieces and can put things together in a way that will, at the end of the day, give me the full product. Now, ARC is a great place, and it's actually pretty big in Canadian terms, but it's still very small when it comes to providing a total solution to a problem. Carbon capture and storage, a great example. We're pretty good on the storage side. We don't do much on the capture side, right? But without the capture, you can't do any storage. So one of the things that went through our mind is how do we bring the skills together? And we looked around and said, well, you know, there are organizations like ARC around the country. They all tend to focus on different things for good reason. I mean, you wouldn't want to be duplicating one another. So isn't there some way to get us together so that we can, first of all, provide complete solutions, but also tackle problems that maybe we couldn't think of tackling ourselves? So even though I might be able to build a house, I might not be able to build a factory, right? But I want to be able to do that. So if I've got a friend in my club or in my sort of stable of colleagues who can build factories, well, then I can solve that problem too. So that's really what it's all. It's as simple as that.
Does that solve just Canada's problems, or does it address problems around the world, or how we can fit better into the global innovation front?
Well, that's a good question, Cheryl, because problems today are more and more global. People honestly, if they're concerned about the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, they don't honestly care where it comes from. What they care about is that it's there and how to reduce it. So our problems today are largely global, and this goes back to these large systems we have and so on. But with the growth in population, that'll continue to be the case. But even without that, technology doesn't know any boundaries, right? And if I'm going to solve a problem, I want to use the best technology I possibly can. So ICANN does give us one other great advantage, and that is critical mass, so that we can more easily hunt the world. It gives us connections that are much broader and more extensive, so we can hunt the world. It gives us the ability to do more, as I said, and it gives us the ability to move the results of that work into the world through similar organizations in other countries and regions. So all of that is really, really important too. I would say we're not quite there yet, but we're moving along that path.
Well, you have some projects on the go. One of them has to do with algae, pond scum. Mm-hmm. How do you top pond scum?
Well, I don't think it's a question about topping things, right? I think pond scum is really great, and it's looking really quite positive. And, it's the reason that we're doing it is because we look to nature in the way that I was talking about earlier, and we said, you know, nature has to have a way to deal with CO2, and it does. And it turned out that algae was one of the best ways, and so we're trying to see, can we make that industrial scale and industrially economic? And so far it's looking like we just might be able to do that. And if we can, we've changed the world. There's no doubt about it. We're now embarked on a second project, which we actually just announced formally this week. You know, we've got insect problems, and in the case of our forests, the mountain pine beetle, to be explicit. But with climate change, there'll be more. That's affecting the wood supply, the forests. That means that we've got to find new ways of either mitigating the problem or preventing the problem. So today we announced a process for mitigating the problem. And that is, okay, the beetles have destroyed the tree, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily made the wood useless. So let's try to figure out ways that we can actually use the wood and continue to use it, rather than just watch it fall down or burn up or whatever it may be. So we've got a project that, through the use of very intelligent sensors, we can actually see the quality of the wood coming in, the color, the nature of what's in it, and so on, and use that knowledge to sort of on the fly modify production systems so that you still yield a quality product such as brilliant white newsprint that will continue to be attractive in the marketplace. A very important thing, I would say.
What would you consider the highlights of your 11 years here as CEO of the Alberta Research Council?
Well, one for sure is ICANN. I think I'm really happy to see that come together and to see the my colleagues around the country sort of buy into it and see the importance and kind of roll up their sleeves and go after it. I think the second thing, though, would be the transition of the organization so that it is really market-oriented. So we're thinking much harder about what really needs to be done and do it in a more disciplined way. In the past, we relied a little more on serendipity and, I will say, individuals to make it happen. What we're trying to do is create methodology that will allow us collectively to find the sweet spots that need attention. And if we can leave that as a process as opposed to something that relies on individuals, that's marvelous as far as I'm concerned. It'll be a real, again, a major step in the way organizations like ours work in the world. I think that the other thing is the fact that we've been able to clearly differentiate ourselves and establish our role in the marketplace as a technology developer and commercializer as opposed to a discovery place. You know, that allows us to say, hey, you know, universities have a very important role, but so do we, and in fact, they're complementary. They're not competitive at all. So I think that's really powerful. And finally, I think probably the most exciting of all is that we've attracted some absolutely incredible people here that are just a dream to work with. And, you know, they're all unique people, so they're very challenging, but they're so committed to making a difference and making the province better and making their country stronger, you know.
With all these big plans and the role for the Alberta Research Council in the future, is this place big enough for you?
Well, we're now at 96% occupancy, which means we have to think for quite a while to even plan someone to relocate from one office to another. So we're really at the limit, actually. Our big challenge is going to be how to create the next piece of infrastructure that'll allow us to sort of continue to add on to what we're able to do. And when we look at the sort of the contribution that comes as a result of what we do, the economic value proposition, I think it should be a no-brainer. But, of course, the reality is there's a lot of politicking that's required to ensure people understand the value proposition very clearly and are able to defend these kinds of investments. It's a little different than the school or the hospital. It's a bit longer term, and so it requires a different mindset to make those kind of investments. But when this particular site, Mill Woods, was built 20 years ago, it was a very, very good piece of foresight on the part of the then government. When ARC was established originally in 1921, it was an incredible statement by the province. And I guess I think it's pretty close to the time when we should maybe make another statement.
We're told that we're really on the verge of the knowledge economy. And if we're going to really survive in a world economy, we have to focus on knowledge and knowledge transfer. Has the public really come to understand that? We hear about it all the time around the universities and certainly within our scientific community. But has that message really gotten out and been embraced by the public?
I think there is a great misunderstanding, actually. Innovation and commercialization is certainly thought of by many in government as taking ideas and creating brand new breakthrough home run style agendas that are sort of new and different. I think that essentially is built around the assumption that if we've got some science, all we have to do is apply it and then we'll be successful. I think increasingly in the certainly in the community of which I'm familiar, people are beginning more and more to question that, because it's not that we don't need knowledge. We do. And we need people who constantly are thinking and developing. But the fundamental role of the university is to create people who can think and create people who know how to do research and people who have the skills to be able to apply technology in the workplace. Most of those people don't stay in the universities. Most of them go to work in industry or in other places. And most of the value propositions, most of the wealth that gets created actually comes from incremental activities, from problem solving around issues that exist within our economy as it is today. Now, there are always going to be breakthroughs, and they're very important, and they will change the world. But it's a bit like trying to win the World Series and only count home runs, right? If you only counted your home runs, you'd never get to the World Series. And if you were in the World Series and only counted home runs, you'd lose. Because it's the guys that are doing the singles and the doubles and the triples, they're just sort of toughing out the day-to-day incremental bits of whatever that really keep economies going. So we have to get people's minds around the fact that the applied research, problem-oriented work, whole solutions as opposed to science, market pull, industry-based inputs have to come to bear. Now, that doesn't just mean the problem that they know about today, because as we spoke about earlier, you have to be able to look far enough ahead to see the emerging problems too. And I can tell you, even as recently as 4 or 5 years ago, when I was speaking to the energy industry, for example, and saying, guys, the need to deal with CO2 is imminent. And they didn't like to hear that, but it was important that they knew it and that they were told. And at the end of the day, they actually came to the table with money to help us come to grips with these problems. So we need organizations that kind of come at it from that point of view, but also that come at it from the public interest point of view, not just the interests of the individual scientist who wants to work in the area, right? So it's not that I want money because I got a pet project. It's we need to collaborate to be able to solve the really important problems that we share together. Those are the ones that really, really matter, and where organizations like this are so important. So it's not a one side or the other side, but it is, we do need honest recognition that both are necessary.
Well, perhaps you could give me an example of the challenge you face with this.
Well, it's interesting that until the Second World War, there was a high level of recognition that most change came as a result of the continuum of improvements that went on in products and so on. The big changes, the wholesale changes in society are rare and they have long gaps between them. You know, things like people like Kondratiev, who talk about long waves and so on, recognize that. The big changes happen maybe every 40, 50, 60 years in society. And they are, yes, they have a technological underpinning, no doubt about it. But they tend to be focused on one sector. All the other sectors, even at that time of change, tend to make, they're living within continuums of improvement. So there's a lot of incrementalism and so on. It's not these wholesale disruptive technologies that people talk about. But after the Second World War, Vannevar Bush in the U.S. basically sold the Americans on what's called the linear model of innovation. And that model presumes that innovation is about applying science, which implies that all you got to do is go and find science and apply it, right? And that I just push it along the pipe and everything will be wonderful. That's dominated certainly North American thinking and much of the world's thinking about innovation ever since, and certainly the public policy element of it. Now, what that means is governments then say, well, how do I solve the problems of the innovation system? Well, clearly, I need to put more in the front end. So they keep dumping more and more and more into what I would call the fundamental science engine, which is valuable and important because it's the place where researchers learn to do research, and it's the place where academics like to work and so on. But it's not where the real value proposition comes from. And so increasingly now we hear concerns and frustrations about where's the value from all this, right? So a few years ago, of course, the university said, well, we'll triple the value proposition. Hasn't happened, but I mean, the motivation was good. But it's all still built on this sort of fundamentally flawed argument that it's a pipe. And I just have to put enough good things in the front and great stuff will come out the back. And it isn't. And that really is the challenge that we've got today, is to realize that the world of academia is primarily about creating the people. And the world of business and the economy is about using the people and using the ideas, right, and the et cetera, to solve the problems and make them more successful by being more productive or whatever. Organizations like ours really come at it from that perspective. And I guess what I would like to see, I think the politicians are now getting it, but I'd like to see the sort of government departments and so on begin to appreciate the fact as well that really is where it has to come from. So again, it's not that one is bad or one is, is good. Both are necessary. And if I could use my old house analogy again, I can't build a house just by piling up more and more shingles on the front lawn, right? It's not going to be much of a house and nobody would really want to live in it. So I've got to have all the pieces together to make it work well. I've got to value all the different trades or the different pieces of our infrastructure, because at the end of the day, we want innovation to be successful. Today, we're left with a situation where North America is becoming really a producer of raw science or early stage technology that we export to the rest of the world at very cheap prices. It's the same thing when we talk about being hewers of wood and drawers of water. We're becoming the same thing with science and technology because we don't move it along the path and actually turn it into products.
Thank you very much, John.
Cheryl, it's always fun to talk to you.